Hello, and welcome back to Such Stuff, the podcast from Shakespeare's Globe. You might have noticed we've been taking a little season break, but now we're back and well underway with the summer season here at Shakespeare's Globe. Throughout the summer season, the Globe stage will be home to three history plays which ask huge questions about leadership and leadership battles, power and the loss of power, truth and responsibility. And across the three plays, Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, and Henry V, three iconic and traditionally male Shakespearean parts, Hotspur, Falstaff and King Henry V, will all be played by women. As our Globe ensemble takes to the stage every week, the plays will change and shift and resonate with our own political moment. At the start of this remarkable process, the Globe hosted the Women in Power Festival, exploring questions around what it means to lead and what it means to lead as a woman in politics, in academia and, of course, in the arts. So this week on the podcast, we'll be going behind the scenes with the Women in Power Festival, asking what the relationship between women and power is now, what it means to occupy spaces that have been traditionally male or masculine, how the voices that came before us can inspire us moving forwards, and what the relationship between women and power might look like in the future. So here's Farah, who convened the festival, to introduce it properly.
The Women in Power Festival at the Globe is a one-week festival looking at the relationship that women have or don't have to power. So we've been hosting events which are giving a voice to a lot of women who are underrepresented. It's an intersectional festival. It's looking at women across all social classes, all races, all abilities, etc. So we've had a night looking at what it means to be a female director in the theater industry in Britain today. 40 years of activism with Clean Break Theatre Company and the activist group Southall Black Sisters. We're having Donna Zuckerberg talk about her book Not All Dead White Men, which exposes the misogynistic online community. And then we're going to have a symposium looking at women in leadership. The reason we wanted to do this is because we knew that our artistic director, Michelle Terry, was going to be programming history plays and casting women as kings. And we wanted to think about, what does that mean to be a woman in a position of power? How are you received as a woman in a position of power? Do we have models for leadership? Is the only model for leadership the one that men have created over the last 2,000 years? And so when a woman gets into a position of power or leadership, what does she do? What resources does she have to lean on? And what brand of leadership should we be cultivating as women, especially in the 21st century, where women's rights are actually regressing? So I felt it was a really urgent time to do this festival. Power means to me autonomy. It means financial independence. It means having the ability to make my own choices in my work, in my life, how I raise my daughter. Access to power, it has less happy connotations because women generally are barred from access to power. No matter how much we think we've progressed in the West, think about five other countries elsewhere and women haven't even got as far as we are now, and we're not even as far as we need to be. And so if we're going to think about women and access to power, we have to be global about it. And we have to be intersectional about it. And we need men to actually support this, to support women gaining access to power. Because actually, no matter where you go, they are still the ones with all the access. Some of the things I've been learning over the week in some of the discussions we've been having has been really thinking about women bonding together, women collaborating, being proactive, supporting each other. Because I think one of the strategies or tactics of the patriarchal systems that we live in is to pit women against each other. And that enables the power structures that exist to continue to exist. The minute women start working together and supporting each other, then there's hope that that can change.
So we'll be hearing from Sarah Amankwa, who is currently playing Henry V in the Globe's history plays, about what it means to take on the role as a woman and as a woman of colour. We sit down with Claire Van Kampen to talk about the progress she's seen when it comes to the relationship between women and power in her lengthy career across the arts. And we get to grips with the backlash to the gains made when it comes to women and power as we chat to classicist Donna Zuckerberg. Her book, Not All Dead White Men, delves into the murky online world of the alt-right and how they're appropriating classical texts to further a misogynistic and white nationalist agenda. And as we ask how we move forwards with creating access to power for women in a meaningful and intersectional way, we look to the women who came before us for inspiration, with words from Virginia Woolf, read by Women of the Globe. First up, Sarah Manquar is currently playing Henry V on the Globe stage, charting his journey from likely lad to iconic English king, across Henry IV Parts 1 and 2 and Henry V. The role comes with certain expectations. Generations have seen Henry V as a play about a certain kind of Englishness. But the Globe Ensemble has been looking at these plays as if they were new rights, not least with all expectations about casting put aside. Farah sat down with Sarah to ask how she's been getting to grips with the character and the play, what it means as a woman of colour to step into a role that has been the preserve of white male actors, and what she's learned about women in power and herself so far in the run.
Sarah, you're playing Henry V this year.
That's correct.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about that. Obviously, this is contextualized in our discussions that we're having about women's relationship to power, specifically. But the history plays traditionally aren't really places where women get lots of opportunities for performing.
No.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the Globe Ensemble's approach to casting in this trilogy of Henry plays that you're doing.
Yes. So I guess when we first had our meetings for the ensemble, it was sort of pitched to us that we would be looking at these plays as if they were new plays. Mm. So we had no idea what the castings were going to be. I definitely didn't know. Yeah, it was very much the sense of we are approaching these plays with a whole new way of exploring them, so they can be very much set anywhere with anyone playing the king or queen, what have you, and exploring it from that kind of narrative. And for me to have the honor and opportunity to play a king has been one of the most amazing but also toughest challenges I've ever had to take on, surprisingly. But it's just great just approaching a particular narrative that has many assumptions to how it's viewed or who speaks it, who gives it life, if you will, and to be able to be, a sort of conduit as well in that sense, because I've never seen these plays, I've never read these plays, so I, in particular, I guess, came from a very fresh and, if anything, raw perspective.
That's
I've
exciting.
Just sort of saw these people as people,
yeah.
And you know, characters, as opposed to sort of opposing a gender on anyone, and just sort of taking these humans in this world, in this experience, and sharing that, really.
Yeah. Has playing this part made you think about the different ways that men lead and the different ways women lead? Has it made you think about women and leadership or women in power?
It's interesting, actually, because I've tried not to, just to, again, try and not impose anything on the situations and circumstances. However, what's been very interesting is the conversations that have come up with even just me playing the king. You sort of learn very quickly that no one listens to you. Like, oh, great, this is great. This is going to be interesting. But again, and that's not necessarily anything that's done deliberately, of course, but just in terms of what's kind of where we've come from and what we, you know, the environments that we've grown up in, how our culture, backgrounds kind of shape how we view each other in sort of gender differences. So it's very interesting how there is a sort of natural, what's the word, privilege that comes with certain men, you know, intentionally and unintentionally, when they are playing roles with authoritative roles. Mm. And whereas to women, there's this sort of sense of, okay, I sort of have to kind of deal with this sort of nuisance, if you will. And that comes from a long stem of, sort of culture enforced on how we, you know, women have been sort of silenced and, emasculated or however you want to sort of phrase it. So, yeah, it's been very interesting for myself to, again, just sort of taking the task of, okay, I just have to play this person of authority, and then having certain opinions imposed on you is very, very interesting, because then being able to sort of deal with that and deal with the challenges of, in particular, Henry's thought and Henry's kind of pursuits there's a part of me that's sort of like, are you disagreeing with me, Sarah? Or are you disagreeing with the character? Mm-hmm. And sometimes for some people, it can be very hard to differentiate the two, mm-hmm. especially me being a woman of color as well. There is what I've kind of had an ongoing sense of, this sense of being invisible. And obviously that's in and of itself a lie, as every human being has intrinsic worth and dignity and value. Mm-hmm. But then when one is put in a position where they have to somewhat lead, there is that that they have to contest with. They have to contest with people's backgrounds, people's views and opinions. Yes, long-winded answer.
No, but a really interesting answer, actually, because it leads into other questions that I have, because obviously you've been playing it for a couple weeks now, and I'm curious about the audience and how they're sort of connecting to you as King Henry, because obviously this part has this sort of legacy of the great English king, the big white male authority of the past, and even Shakespeare sort of I guess alludes to that legacy, doesn't he? Because he had that legacy in Shakespeare's time. So I'm wondering how you're dealing with the challenges of all those assumptions that are on his character.
Yeah, that's a really hard question. Short answer, I don't know just yet. In all honesty, every day, every show, even today, I was just sort of like, oh gosh, God help me get through this show, because it's very hard to gauge. I mean, obviously you can only take, you know, what people sort of give you, and some people have been very encouraging with, you know, and very forward thinking in the sense of, you know, seeing myself play this character. But it's very hard to come on the stage and deliver this narrative and try and read or understand what the eyes are telling you. And obviously in the space like the Globe, it's so exposing, so there's that, and you know, being able to sort of say, you know, once more onto the breach, and then you're sort of having, you know, this predominantly, if you will, white audience looking at you, predominantly male as well. And there's, you know, there's parts of the sort of inner psyche that's like, you know, this sort of has this imposter syndrome of I don't think I'm supposed to be here. Sorry, I'm just gonna leave now. And I think that's partly what Michelle in particular wanted to tackle. And there's a part of me that's sort of like, wow, I feel like I'm at times this sort of sacrificial lamb that's kind of been pushed on. But nonetheless, nonetheless, it's something that I'm very passionate about, in particular with art. And I think for those who come to see, for one, they already know that I'm playing Henry V, so the fact that they're looking at me is saying a lot. So the challenges come every day, but I think a lot of it's very much internal challenges, challenges that I have personally faced, dealing with racism in the industry, dealing with sexism as well. So there's, you know, so many aspects of that that I am carrying within Sarah's personhood, and having to sort of meet that and push through. It's kind of not a yes and no answer. It's sort of still being navigated through, and it's very exciting. It's very exciting, because the amount of questions that I've had to ask myself, and I have to keep reminding myself at the end of the day, Sarah, these humans are humans, and they're broken, and they're, you know, they're fallible. And at the end of the day, that's what, for me anyway, I am on this journey to expose, that leadership, male or female, isn't going to be perfect. And regardless of how people assume this legacy within Britain, within Henry V, it's always going to have some blind spots. There's always going to be, you know, with our politicians, our leaders today, they're not perfect. And I think for me, it's being able to show that, if anything, so that we are able to at least have that same grace with each other as well. That's kind of been my pursuit, or my reminder, if you will.
So to what extent is really, you've probably kind of answered this in many ways, but to what extent is your identity being brought to bear upon how you're sort of crafting this character?
Good question.
I mean, it may not be something until the end of the run that you're really fully conversant with.
Yeah, I guess. So when you say just to see if I understood your question correctly, my identity as a woman of color. Yes.
Yeah.
I think without having to, it's interesting actually, because I guess touching on what I'd said in the previous question, I think, which you'd alluded to, being able to again strip back, and by stripping back I don't mean denying my gender and my race. But at the same time, all I have are his words.
Yeah.
That's all I have. And there are times where, I guess through the whole process, having to sort of suppress this imposter syndrome and sort of be like, okay, well, I've been given this word, these words. And whenever I sort of walk on to the space, even to this day, you know, hearing Here Comes Your Majesty, I have to believe that they're talking about me. I sort of look over my shoulder, I'm like, oh, wow, they're talking to me. And I think in that sense as well, that can be somewhat relatable to the character in his journey of having to wrestle with his identity and being this sort of reluctant king and having to kind of take on the sins of his father and all of that, I think has allowed me as Sarah to wade into those kind of issues. But then at the same time, with the face I have, with the amazing God-given body that I have, I'm able to stand and speak with a voice, that people are less exposed to, says something else, which I'm still yet to discover, actually. And I think there's a part of that which, whether people want to call it humility or not, I think it's, for me, it's just, I kind of have a delayed response to things anyway. So I think allowing whatever that is, when I speak his words, for those people to engage, especially with speeches like Upon the King and you know, Crispin's Day, there is something that, again, we tend to, certain things that we don't get when we don't have a woman's perspective, which makes it even more poignant, because obviously we're so used to seeing things from a white male perspective, to then have a woman, if anything, a woman of color, who in society, in my opinion, is very much the lowest of the low, to be able to speak such words, to be visible, for me says so many other things, which I think is quite a powerful message that I think is an absolute honor to be a part of, sort of history in the making, if you will.
It really is. Fantastic. Have a great season. And
thank you
so much for joining us on
Thanks
the podcast.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. Thank you.
Next up, as a classicist and academic, Donna Zuckerberg might not seem like a likely candidate to stand on the front line against the darkest recesses of the internet. But when she stumbled across online groups who were using the classical texts and ideas she worked with every day to further a misogynistic and racist agenda, she started the research that led her to write Not All Dead White Men. So what has the ancient Greek philosophical idea of Stoicism got to do with white nationalists? And what has The Art of Love, a book by the ancient Roman poet Ovid, got to do with pickup artists and incels? Here's Donna.
So Donna, you've just published a really fascinating expose of the alt-right and misogynist online communities in your book, Not All Dead White Men. And I feel like it does tell us a little bit about the way that these groups use classical texts to advance this sort of awful, dangerous agenda. And you also give us some sort of guidance about how to cope with it as well. Can you tell our audiences how you came to research this topic and how you coped with the material once you got digging?
So it started in late summer 2015. I launched an online classics publication called Eidolon in early 2015. And then in August, we had our first big hit, which was an article called Why is Stoicism Having a Cultural Moment? And I was searching for the sources of the traffic for the article, which was much higher than I expected it to be. And I found some of the traffic coming from Reddit, which was a little alarming for those who know Reddit. Reddit can be a sort of dark place, but it was actually quite a nice subreddit about Stoicism, where people sort of debate how to apply Stoic ideas to the difficulties in their lives. So somebody had posted our article and they were debating about it, but there was a commenter who had been downvoted a lot by the community, because it turns out that red pill people are not actually well-liked by the rest of the Stoicism community. So there was a commenter who had responded to this thread saying that he thought that the red pill was the reason why Stoicism was rising in popularity again, because the red pill was so interested in Stoicism. And that struck me as deeply bizarre, because if I had one word to describe the red pill and my experience with it before that time, it probably would have been angry. And that's the opposite of Stoicism. So the Red Pill is an online community of mostly men, mostly between the ages of 18 and 35, mostly straight, mostly white, who are united by the idea that our society, and by our society we usually mean U.S. society, but Western society, discriminates against straight white men. And they believe that they have attained enlightenment that allows them to see that they are discriminated against when most of society thinks that the opposite is true. And this metaphor, the red pill, comes from the movie The Matrix, where Neo swallows a red pill, which allows him to see the world for how it really is. And initially, the red pill was really focused on men's rights movements, and then kind of gradually shifted from there to misogyny, and it grew to include the pickup artist community and also allied communities, which don't have exactly the same view, but share a common worldview about what they call the sexual marketplace, which, I mean, it's what it sounds like. Everybody is sort of allotted a sexual marketplace value, and everybody's trying to get the highest value, significant other, that they can. So the pickup artists are one way of looking at the sexual marketplace. The men going their own way are another group. They think that the sexual marketplace is so skewed against men that the only thing to do is to opt out entirely. And then the incels, who have been getting quite a lot of press lately, are another way of looking at the same worldview, and they believe that they're the losers in the sexual marketplace. They're so unattractive that they will never be able to convince women to sleep with them. And then over the course of 2016, this group grew to include anti-Semites, vocal white nationalists, and even people who identify as neo-Nazis, and then people who wouldn't identify as white nationalists or neo-Nazis. This is the group that calls itself the alt-light. So they're aware of all the sort of negative baggage attached to those terms and instead see themselves as the defenders of Western civilization, which is itself for them essentially a code for white culture. So all of those groups sort of fall under this larger umbrella of the red pill, and they exist almost exclusively online in virtual fora, you know, Reddit, 4chan, 8chan, various blogs. So I decided to look further into that, and at around the same time, I was working on a comparative project about Ovid and pickup artists. And then I began to notice pickup artists actually talking about Ovid, which I hadn't expected. I'd expected it to be comparative, as I said. I did not expect it to be a reception project. So at that point where I had these two very different threads, you know, where one with the pickup artist and Ovid and one with sort of the red pill more generally and Stoicism, it began to look like a much bigger project about this online community and classical antiquity. So I started researching and I started writing the book in late 2015. When I started, it was really about anti-feminism and misogyny. That was the primary focus of the community. They were still sort of coming off of Gamergate. I don't know if your audience will be familiar with that. It was a largely American movement of video in the video game community. Reaction to the rise of progressivism and feminism in the video game community. Very focused on harassing female game developers and female game journalists. And that was really where they developed a lot of their online terror tactics. You know, doxing, revealing people's identifying documents. SWATting, right? Placing calls to the FBI that make it sound like there's something terrible going at their house, so a SWAT team shows up. Gosh. Tactics like that were developed during the Gamergate era and have continued on to today. Anyway, so I was writing this book and researching it throughout 2016, and I watched as these communities went from being primarily anti-feminist to becoming anti-feminist and anti-Semitic, which had always been there, but it became much louder. And then by the end of 2016, you know, the rise of the alt-right, really very vocally white nationalist. And that was all, that shift happened while I was doing this research.
Fascinating.
And it was tough to watch, you know. I set myself sort of strict limits for how much I could research on their sites per day. Because otherwise, I think I would have gone off the deep end. Sort of an hour per day, or if I hit something that was so gross that I felt like I just needed to sit down and close my computer and play with my dog, then I did that.
Yeah. But it's really interesting what you were saying about in 2016, you actually are able to, you were able to chart that shift while you were actually researching it. And obviously the sort of rise of populism in the country and Donald Trump's election and all of that may have contributed to the, I suppose, feelings of courage that these groups now
absolutely
have. They're emboldened in some way, aren't they?
That's exactly right. I remember how excited they were after the election. And one of them posted a sort of celebratory article on his website that said, now if you rank women on a scale of 1 to 10 and openly talk about how hot they are, people will say, you sound like the President of the United States.
So you're no doubt aware of the issues in the United States that the medieval community, the medievalists, are having.
Yes.
With white supremacists who are co-opting medieval literature ideas and iconography in order to reinforce their own ideology. And of course, your book points out what's happening in classics. In some ways, I feel like it won't be long before they come for Shakespeare. And of course, the Nazis in Nazi Germany already came for Shakespeare.
Right.
So I'm wondering what advice you might have for those of us who are sort of custodians of, teachers of, scholars of, and lovers of these classic texts.
Yeah, they undoubtedly will. Mm. They're cherry pickers, right? There doesn't need to be a real coherent historical narrative. So the first piece of advice I would give is that it's incredibly tempting when you see the mistakes or the sort of very shallow surface readings in what they do to focus on correcting that. Mm. And although I do think that that's important to a certain extent, you know, it's our job as scholars to try to disseminate accurate understanding of the material we study, don't mistake that for actually responding or counteracting their influence in a substantive way, because you will never convince a white supremacist not to be white supremacist by correcting him about Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Right? That's a lesson that I think a lot of people learn the hard way. They would sort of point out a mistake and think, well, if this person makes obvious mistakes, then nobody will pay attention to what they're saying. And really, that is never true. Mm. It doesn't matter. You have to point out the ideology underneath. And you have to do the hard work of showing some people that the kind of unthinking assumptions behind why they are drawn to Shakespeare might be the same as the reasons why white supremacists are drawn to Shakespeare. Mm. That's been one of the hardest things in classics, is that a lot of classicists fall back on narratives about the foundations of Western civilization, which are also narratives that are very attractive to the far right.
Yes. Yeah, those are actually two really, really good tips. And the first one that you mentioned, that is a really easy trap to fall into, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. That was one of the first things that my editor said to me when I was writing this book. It was on the Ovid chapter, actually. And there was a lot more sort of pointing out mistakes they made with a sort of winky, you know, like, ha ha, look how dumb they are kind of undertone. And she said to me, Donna, it doesn't make you a better person than they are because you know more about Ovid.
Yeah.
And she was right.
Thank you, Donna. And thank you for being on the front line and for writing this book.
Oh, thank you.
It's an extraordinary book. And we really appreciate you coming here and speaking tonight.
Next up, Farah sat down with composer, playwright and director Claire Van Kampen to talk about her career leading orchestras, companies and teams in the arts industry. How has her own relationship with power changed? How has others' perception of her positions of authority changed? And what gives her hope for the future of women leading from the front in the arts industry?
Claire, thank you for being with us today. I wanted to ask you about something definitional. If you could talk about what it means to be a female leader. You work in the arts, you're a composer, a director, a playwright. And I wonder if you could just sort of elaborate for us on what it means for you as a woman to be in this field.
Well, I think we're redefining what leadership means more and more. And today's symposium was no exception, really, because my fellow panelists just gave me so many insights about the developing forms of leadership that they're encountering and engendering. Mm. when I first became, if you would say, the leader of what I was doing, it was probably 20, 30 years ago when we assumed more of a male cloak as female leaders. We led in that form, in the way that men were leading. That's all we could do because our role models weren't there in the way that they are for some of these younger women now. So I would say that my ability to lead and my thoughts about my own leadership are ever-changing, and particularly now, almost exponentially, as the world is now focusing itself so much on gender and what it is to be led by particularly female gender in the workplace.
A lot of people have this imposter syndrome, but I hear women talk about it more than I hear men talk about it. So whether or not men actually suffer with it but just don't mention it, and women are more open about mentioning it, I wonder if you could talk about the concept of imposter syndrome, and did you ever suffer it, and what advice would you give to younger women who are sort of dealing with their own sense of imposter syndrome?
I think this is a very real problem, and it is not just a problem for women of my generation. I mean, you know, when I went to school, I heard rhetoric which contained phrases such as, women can't drive, they make bad drivers. No woman has ever written a symphony. Name 10 women poets of excellence. That kind of thing. So I started to think that perhaps all the things that I wanted to do, I wouldn't be able to do because I was female. It's something that can be so implanted in you that you're not even conscious of it. And it informs the whole of your life and the whole of your interface with what you want to do in life, your ambitions. And it creates an enormous anxiety and fear. So that when you step into what it is you feel you want to do and can do, it's very difficult to lose those critical voices which say, oh, you're going to fall on your face. You're never going to be able to do that. Why not let a man do that? They know how to do it. Do you really know how to do this? And it doesn't help that, certainly when I started out in my professional life, I was openly questioned by the men I was leading, particularly in orchestral bands and in administrative sections of my work. I was challenged by men who perceived me as taking their job. So I think the imposter syndrome has to be addressed at a very early level for females in school. I don't think our education system is geared towards it. It's geared to achievement and success on the page, but not on the stage of life. Not enough. But now I think we're starting to develop, particularly over the last, say, 18 months, 2 years, to develop female role models that give us more assurity of who we are and who we might become. And it all comes down to developing your sense of authenticity, self-authenticity, discovering who you really are. Once you bond with that, then you are not so much in danger of falling into the imposter syndrome.
I think, obviously, you've talked a lot about the fact that things were different when you were younger, and we've seen a lot of progress in the last 50 years. What challenges are there now, and how would you advise young women about taking on the next 50 years and in terms of progress? I know that's a huge question.
Well, it's a very important question because I see there's a fork in the road. We can go down the side of the fork that we know, which is to be militant, adversarial, combative, to take on sort of face to face those who don't agree with us or who are objectionable. Or we can develop another route, and we're still discovering what that might be, but I think it is to do with the collective nature of a democratic collective view of how to proceed, which is to do with empathy, compassion, education, and understanding. For example, if I am faced now with someone who is blatantly sexist, let's say, towards me, I no longer think, is that person right? And therefore pull that question back to myself and get angry about it. I now think they must feel very threatened to feel that. This means that their world can't be very stable to them in the way that my world is more and more becoming stable in an interior sense to me. Because the more I know myself, the more I feel I can operate in the world. So in a sense, it doesn't mean that you're excusing or condoning this behavior, but you're putting yourself in a position where you're not its victim. And I think we don't really know how to do this yet, but we are, if we can find out a methodology to combat these problems without being adversarial and take another approach, I suppose you could say it's conflict resolution in a peaceful way, then I think the world will really change. If we don't, it won't change. It'll just keep going backwards and forwards, and we won't move forward in a true sense.
Well, my last question then is thinking really about the theater industry as it is today and the world of classical theater, Shakespeare. Is it still, in your view, dominated by men who are, you know, often Oxbridge educated? Or do you see some change happening and do you feel optimistic?
Actually, seeing what Michelle Terry is doing with the Globe, I feel incredibly optimistic. She's in charge, although she won't like that phrase, of the most incredible experiment where she is changing and sort of smashing old forms of how we do Shakespeare and how we put it on the stage. It's no longer dominated by that Oxbridge sort of white middle class male, highly educated person who tells actors how to be on a stage and what to do with the text. The actors are given enormous responsibility. I think that's a very true model, personally, of how it originally was in the day the playwright wrote the plays. So for me, that feels very, very inspiring. I think theatre is changing. I think that's very difficult for a lot of people who don't want it to change and don't want the structures to change. More and more, I think we need to enable people to go to the theatre. We need to make it a place that is so attractive they will put down their iPhones and their tablets and their television programmes and want to go out and be social together. And that's why the Globe is such a unique space in the world of theatre, because it's a social space where people see each other. And real theatre, the blood and guts of theatre, is where change happens. And that's what the Globe is all about for me.
Thank you. Thank you, Claire, and thank you for inspiring us with your work today.
When it comes to women in power, it sometimes feels like we've been having this conversation for far too long, but we still have so much further to go. To move forwards, we look to the women who came before us. A Room of One's Own by Virginia Woolf is a seminal feminist text, fighting for a space for women, both literal and imaginative. In a particular passage, she imagines what would have happened if Shakespeare had had a younger sister, as adventurous and imaginative as him, but bound by the constraints of her age.
Cats do not go to heaven. Women cannot write the plays of Shakespeare. It would have been impossible, completely and entirely, for any woman to have written the plays of Shakespeare in the age of Shakespeare. Let me imagine, since facts are so hard to come by, what would have happened had Shakespeare had a wonderfully gifted sister, called Judith, let us say. Shakespeare himself went, very probably, his mother was an heiress, to the grammar school, where he may have learnt Latin, Ovid, Virgil and Horace, and the elements of grammar and logic. He was, it is well known, a wild boy, who poached rabbits, perhaps shot a deer, and had, rather sooner than he should have done, to marry a woman in the neighbourhood, who bore him a child rather quicker than was right. That escapade sent him to seek his fortune in London. He had, it seemed, a taste for the theatre. He began by holding horses at the stage door. Very soon he got work in the theatre, became a successful actor, and lived at the hub of the universe, meeting everybody, knowing everybody, practising his art on the boards, exercising his wits in the street, and even getting access to the palace of the Queen. Meanwhile, his extraordinarily gifted sister, let us suppose, remained at home. She was as adventurous, as imaginative, as agog to see the world as he was. But she was not sent to school. She had no chance of learning grammar and logic, let alone of reading Horace and Virgil. She picked up a book now and then, one of her brother's perhaps, and read a few pages. But then her parents came in and told her to mend the stockings or mind the stew and not moon about with books and papers. They would have spoken sharply, but kindly, for they were substantial people who knew the conditions of life for a woman and loved their daughter. Indeed, more likely than not, she was the apple of her father's eye. Perhaps she scribbled some pages up in an apple loft on the sly, but was careful to hide them or set fire to them. Soon, however, before she was out of her teens, she was to be betrothed to the son of a neighbouring wool stapler. She cried out that marriage was hateful to her, and for that she was severely beaten by her father. Then he ceased to scold her. He begged her instead not to hurt him, not to shame him in this matter of her marriage. He would give her a chain of beads or a fine petticoat, he said, and there were tears in his eyes. How could she disobey him? How could she break his heart? The force of her own gift alone drove her to it. She made up a small parcel of her belongings, let herself down by a rope one summer's night, and took the road to London. She was not 17. The birds that sang in the hedge were not more musical than she was. She had the quickest fancy, a gift like her brother's, for the tune of words. Like him, she had a taste for the theatre. She stood at the stage door. She wanted to act, she said. Men laughed in her face. The manager, a fat, loose-lipped man, guffawed. He bellowed something about poodles dancing and women acting. No woman, he said, could possibly be an actress. He hinted, you can imagine what. She could get no training in her craft. Could she even seek her dinner in a tavern or roam the streets at midnight? Yet her genius was for fiction and lusted to feed abundantly upon the lives of men and women and the study of their ways. At last, for she was very young, oddly like Shakespeare the poet in her face, with the same grey eyes and rounded brows, at last Nick Green, the actor-manager, took pity on her. She found herself with child by that gentleman, and so, who shall measure the heat and violence of the poet's heart when caught and tangled in a woman's body? She killed herself one winter's night, and lies buried at some crossroads where the omnibuses now stop outside the Elephant and Castle. That, more or less, is how the story would run, I think, if a woman in Shakespeare's day had had Shakespeare's genius.
That was read by the lovely Lucy Butterfield from our comms team. That's it from us, but you can catch Sarah Amankwa and the rest of the Globe Ensemble on the Globe stage until the 11th of October. Donna Zuckerberg's brilliant, if a little terrifying book, Not All Dead White Men, is out now and you can pick up a copy in our bookshop. Look out for more festivals and events like Women in Power coming to the Globe soon. Tickets and more information about all of our productions and events can be found on our website. You've been listening to Such Stuff with me, Imogen Greenberg, and Dr. Farah Karim Cooper. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe and what's on, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be back with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe, so subscribe wherever you got this podcast from.